Hello and welcome to Better Places, where we talk all things planning, politics and development. We're starting 2025 off with a bang by bringing clarity to the Labour government's planning changes and those made to local government in December of last year. Consilio's Managing Director Nick Dines was joined for a fascinating and insightful conversation with the country's highest rated planning solicitor of the last 15 years, Simon Ricketts, partner at Town Legal. We do hope you enjoy our first episode of 2025.
The run-up to Christmas saw a flurry of activity in the planning world, so we thought here at Consilio there was no better way to start the new year than trying to bring clarity to the hundreds and thousands of words published, hopefully making the way forward appear clearer. And who better to speak to than Simon Ricketts, who has been ranked as the country's most highly rated planning solicitor for the last 15 years in Planning Magazine's annual survey and author of the must-read Simon City blog. Thank you for joining us, Simon. I hope you had a relaxing Christmas and New Year break.
I did. Possibly too relaxing. Got to get back into it now.
Well, I think we will with this conversation. We've got a lot to cover. As it's clear that the government sees planning reform as one of the main levers it can pull to get the country growing again, with ambitious targets for housing and infrastructure, dependent, it seems, upon a speeding up in the government's eyes of the planning process, which is something I'm sure the majority listening to this conversation will agree with in principle. In December, we really saw how this could take shape with, and an intake of breath, a statement from the Housing Minister in the House of Commons, building the homes we need, the government response to the MPPF consultation and other changes to the planning system, the new version of the MPPF, the outcome of a new standard method for assessing local housing need, the housing delivery test measurement rulebook, planning policy for travellers sites, revised elements of the planning practice for housing and economic needs assessments, the English devolution white paper, and to cap it all off on December the 19th, a compulsory purchase process and compensation reforms consultation paper. Now, I'm not proposing we cover all of these in a Joe Rogan-esque 4-hour long podcast, but before we delve into some of the details, Simon, what has been your impression of the government post-election, for new government, on planning matters in general, and was releasing this massive information in such a short period of time in December ambitious, or showing the urgency with which the government is taking planning reform?
Well, I have to say I've been impressed that the government, and particularly the planning minister, has actually got on with things, but that's because they have to. You know, they know in order to get re-elected they have to deliver close to 1.5 million homes this parliament. That's one of their measurable milestones, one of the six missions, kicking economic growth. So they really had to get on with it. And all I can be grateful for is that this is the first of three Christmases where it didn't all land on Christmas Eve or the day before Christmas Eve.
There was a rumour about it, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was supposed to be Christmas Eve, I remember.
Yeah, it could have been worse. Could have been worse.
Well, it could have been worse. It's a good way to start. But I'd just like to start with a statement in the House of Commons from Matthew Pennycook. It's laid the groundwork for a lot of the many documents that were published. And I read this as a solid statement of intent from a government that does want to move apace. And it contained the words, delivering on our promise to radically reform the planning system. The minister said that just 220,000 new homes were built last year. But whilst we're all frustrated with the slow moving planning system, I mean, developers I speak to say that, yes, along with planning, issues such as the Building Safety Act, affordable housing requirements, the expense of mortgages post list trusts in 40 days, and construction costs soaring, certainly following the Ukraine war, they also need to be taken into account when we look at the lack of delivery. Leaving aside the rights and wrongs of the points I just made there, do you agree with the government that the planning system needs to be radically reformed in order to get more homes and the associated infrastructure built?
I think politicians can't resist using phrases like radically reformed. They can't say reformed without saying radically. They can't say review without saying wholesale, you know, root and branch, turbocharge. It's language. Reform is needed, but there's nothing at all wrong with the structure, and I don't think anyone really is saying that there is.
Okay, so reform, most definitely. Radical, we will just go through in this conversation as we look at the various points which are looking to be changed.
Centrist dads, all of us, aren't we?
Oh, well, indeed. So on 12th of December, which is when the MPPF Rise of was published, it is my birthday, and I was firmly ensconced in my mid-40s as a centrist dad. So the revised MPPF published on the 12th of December replaced the government's previous government, one that was published in December 2023. Putting you on the spot, in 20 words or less, what was your initial takeaway of the revised MPPF? I'll be counting as well.
Deep breath. I probably would say no longer any hiding place for authorities from meeting local housing needs. But I may go over the word limit here. Developers must play their part and pay their way.
Right. The six key themes that I picked up on from the MPPF, and please feel free to add or contradict, but I saw as the main points were the reintroduction of mandatory housing targets and the restoration of the five-year housing land supply requirement, which is what you touched on with your initial comment there, a new standard method for housing needs, grey belt and green belt policies, golden rules for major development, and also local plan updates. With respect to local plans, councils have 12 weeks from the 12th of December to commit to a timetable for updating their local plans, which means by March the 12th, they must have updated local plans in place or at least demonstrate significant progress towards updating them. And currently, only one third of councils have local plans in place. And in his ministerial statement, Matthew Pennycook said, if plans are not progressed, we will use the full range of ministerial intervention powers at our disposal if that does not happen, including taking over an authority's plan making directly. And then further wielding the stick, he also said, rapidly driving up planning consents in the context of a system with woefully inadequate local plan coverage will increase the number of permissions secured outside of local allocations in the short term, which is necessary if we are to see the scale of delivery we need for the 1.5 million homes, which has always been mentioned. Therefore, it implies presumption in favour of sustainable development must have real teeth. The changes we make today ensure that the presumption carries real weight, acting as a significant adjustment to decision-making balance in favour of approving development. I mean, cue a sharp take of breath, I would imagine, at a lot of councils across England who... This is really strong stuff, it seems to me. But what do you think the impact of this approach to local plan formulation will mean in reality?
I think it is really strong stuff because, as I said, I think there is so much of a hiding place for local authorities, and the final version of the MPPF makes it even more difficult for authorities who might have been tempted to race to get a plan in place to bank housing figures based on the old methodology, because by July 2026 a 20% buffer will then be applied, etc. So I think what it's going to mean is authorities will need to, and you know, I think the local politics can't be local political tensions can't be underestimated, but they are going to need to grapple with how to bring forward plans that that accommodate the numbers that are being thrown up, and in the meantime developers will be well aware that there's the opportunity to make applications for planning permission relying on the tilted balance. And you know, your summary of the themes of the MPPF were really good, but I would add an enhanced presumption in favour of development in relation to brownfield development, where you can show that there's need for the development. So I do think we're going to see much more plan making, a lot of gnashing of teeth in relation to that plan making, but also a lot of applications being made outside of plans or where authorities aren't moving fast enough.
Yes, I mean, we've only a third of councils with local plans in England. It's councils in England with local plans in place. It does seem there's an awful lot to cover in a short amount of time for a large number of authorities, and we also know how staff to finances local authorities are generally, and especially in planning departments. So it's quite a challenge for councils, isn't it, to meet this, even though who are willing to embrace this change.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going to be a challenge to hit these timescales.
Absolutely.
So the five-year housing land supply changes, especially coupled with the government's previous announcements on increased requirements for a certain number of councils, would also like to have raised eyebrows in council chambers. In summary, councils must identify and maintain a supply of specific deliverable sites to provide 5 years' worth of housing against the requirement, apply a buffer, and if that wasn't enough, pass the housing delivery test, which measures whether the number of homes built in the past 3 years meet the targets that have been set. So under the test, if you meet less than 95%, you must prepare an action plan to address under delivery. Less than 85%, add a 20% buffer to the 5-year requirement, and less than 75%, you are really on the naughty step, and it's a presumption in favour of sustainable development. Now, currently, 45% of councils has delivered less than 85% of their target, and 25% less than 75%. So practically, I mean, for developer clients which are listening to this, who are looking forward to bring forward developments, what do you think the impact of this is going to be when councils aren't hitting these land supply targets with the government's real favour and presumption of development?
Well, as I said, there are real opportunities, and that is the thrust of the MPPF, that that if local plans are not planning for the necessary growth, then applications for planning permission for unallocated sites may well be looked upon favourably. But as I said, developers must play their part and pay their way. And what I mean by that is, you know, we need schemes which are good schemes, which are well designed, which are not tripped up by external factors such as, you know, issues on ecology, flooding, etc. And although this is going to be hard for a number of projects given issues with viability, you know, schemes are going to need to pay their way in terms of a reasonable approach to affordable housing, because, you know, that is another big thrust of policy as far as Angela Rayner and her team are concerned.
Indeed, if call-ins happen without affordable housing levels a way which at least aligns with the local the need, it's hard to see how they will get through. It's interesting you mentioned good design, because that has been quite a change, hasn't it, from this government, present government to previous. So Michael Gove obviously made a big deal about design, but this government appears to have watered that down. I wonder if you had a view on that.
Yeah, it's difficult to know whether it's just semantics or politics or whether there's anything real behind it, in that, you know, the word beauty has been expunged from the document.
Yes.
That was such a politically loaded word.
And in the eye of the beholder as well. So.
Yeah, but I don't think that clearly doesn't give developers free rein to not come up with well-designed schemes.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are still the requirements for design codes, etc. So, I do think it is in the change is important, but, you know, don't forget about good design.
At the end of the day as well, and, you know,
yeah, absolutely.
The 70s Soviet bloc is probably not in the interest of anybody. But the introduction of Greybelt has garnered considerable press attention. Interestingly, in response to feedback from the initial consultation on the MPPF, the government acknowledged that their first attempt to define Greybelt was likely to leave too much room for subjectivity and debate. They therefore amended the definition and will be providing further guidance on exactly what Greybelt means in the new year. What is your interpretation of Greybelt contained within the current MPF, and do you believe there is enough clarity on its status?
I had a session at the House of Lords Built Environment Committee on precisely this, and the thrust of what I was trying to say was that we shouldn't think that there's a problem if you don't come up with a precise definition, because planning is all about these general tests. And, you know, they have tweaked the Greybelt definition in the glossary to the plan, but it's perfectly sensible as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's land which is in the Greenbelt, comprising previously developed land and or any other land that doesn't contribute to one of three defined purposes for designation of Greenbelt land. It's there is going to be a lot of argument, because talk about beauty being in the eye of the beholder, whether land is Greybelt or not is in the eye of the beholder. And developers are going to be
seeing,
exactly, and local authorities are going to be pushing it the other way. It's going to be really interesting to see the text for the updated planning practice guidance. But I think it's been a really clever way of really starting to look at this politically taboo subject of Greenbelt.
And a Greenbelt being another one of the MPPF's headlines, if you like, certainly within the press. Lay my cards on the table. I've long thought if we want to build family homes in London, which is what all the surveys say people want, actually, to live in a family home, in the major towns and cities of our country, then Greenbelt does need to be reclassified. That's my personal opinion. And that does include fields, not just brownfield in the Greenbelt. What is your thought on how the government is looking to tackle Greenbelt releases laid out in the MPPF?
Well, I think the really radical thing is that the fact that a local authority has land which is greenbelt is no longer going to be, well, is no longer an excuse for not planning to meet its local housing needs. So that is really going to focus local authorities' attention on whether they can accommodate needs without going into the greenbelt. If they do need to go into the greenbelt, then, you know, there is a sort of quasi-sequential approach of brownfield land in the greenbelt, land which can be categorised as grey belt and meets the other requirements in terms of sustainable location and, you know, meeting the golden rules in terms of a level of affordable housing, etc., and only then other areas of greenbelt. It's a logical approach as far as I'm concerned, but I don't think we should kid ourselves. There's going to be a lot of local opposition in many places.
That to me is really does summarise radical, because this really is a fundamental change, isn't it, which could be coming here. I was also interested to see that the government responding to the consultation has altered the 50% affordable requirement for building on the greenbelt. And I found this word interesting. Acknowledging that the high requirement risk leaving authorities with a choice, allow flexibility and turn the amount of affordable housing into a negotiation, or hold firm and make sites unviable, delivering no homes affordable and otherwise. It's quite interesting, because some may say that's the position of many residential developments held up in our cities at present. But putting that to one side, do you agree with a sensible approach that the government is now taking for viability negotiations to take place on these larger strategic sites, which are likely to carry greater infrastructure costs, and the developers can't afford everything?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see the tweaks that were made to the final version of the MPPF, because the draft had this blanket 50% affordable requirement, whereas now it's a requirement of providing 15% above what the local affordable housing target is. If you've got a up-to-date plan, if you haven't, it's 50%. But the other aspect that changed was the fact that until we have updated planning practice guidance on viability testing in relation to greenbelt development, at the moment viability concerns can't be used as a way of arguing down that figure of 15% above policy or 50% otherwise. So I'm not sure whether that's going to cause issues in relation to some schemes which are in the system. I suspect probably not, because when we've been seeing schemes come forward arguing very special circumstances, usually, you know, tactically the promoter has been offering an enhanced affordable housing package of 10 or 15% above what would otherwise be required. So I do think it you know, it's workable. Viability is going to be an issue in some cases, but that's life, isn't it?
Before we move on to the next topic, was there anything else that you wanted to say about the MPPF?
Well, I suppose the one thing we need to think about is that there's going to be another version of the MPPF before long in order to build in the changes to the local plan making process. So nothing stays static for too long in our wonderful world of planning.
But hopefully this will certainly focus minds at local authorities, if nothing else. So if the MPPF wasn't enough to take in before Christmas, on the 16th of December, the government produced the English Devolution White Paper. And I must say, whenever I see any government, regardless of political cover, prepare reforms to local government, I'm reminded of the Sir Humphrey Appleby quote from the Yes Minister: "Local government is a wonderful institution. It allows for central government to pretend that it is not responsible for local problems." Now, this especially ran true when I read the line from the Deputy Prime Minister in the introduction that the bill will mean a permanent shift of power away from Whitehall and into the hands of those who know their communities best. Before we get into the details of the bill, what is your perspective of the current local government structure as it is? Do you agree with the premise that reform and consistency across the country is desired, as the government is now looking to introduce?
I mean, the current structure is sort of chaotic, random.
So that's a yes.
So, it does need to be brought into some logical order. There is going to be still some element of randomness to it, isn't there? Because this is not going to be a root and branch reform that starts with a blank piece of paper. But it is surely much needed, because the previous government's approach was a very tactical approach of dangling carrots and hoping that led.
Please slowly come towards the water. But as a former councillor myself, I do enjoy getting into the weeds of detail about local government. But even the AI platform I was using to assist me to prepare for this was struggling to put everything together because there was just so much in it. However, I believe there are two areas to focus on with respect to planning and changes to the political framework that listeners to the Better Places podcast will be interested in. Firstly, there are strategic authorities that will be established in areas with populations over 1.5 million. By 2029, the government would like to see the whole country covered with. Now, bear with us, please, listeners. There are two proposed. There's foundation strategic authorities and mayoral strategic authorities. Now, the foundations are the first steps in areas of the country not currently covered by a strategic authority. They won't have an elected mayor, but will still have significant powers. And they'll be comprised of non-mayoral combined authorities and combined county authorities, so a number of local authorities and counties coming together. Now, for relation to our world, they will need to produce a spatial development strategy with the support of a majority of constituent members, which I take to mean the local authorities, in support. If not, if there is not timely agreement on such a strategy, then the Secretary of State can intervene. The bill, English Devolution Bill, in the section Universal System of Strategic Planning, makes it clear that the model for proposals is based on the London Plan, meaning they will guide development for local planning authorities in the area. Now, in my very long-winded way, that was my way of setting up this question. Given your experience with the London Plan over the last two decades, how fundamental do you believe this change will be for areas that do not currently have a spatial development strategy, which is literally half the country, at least, as we'll come on to with the powers that some mayoral authorities have currently? And do you think it will improve the decision-making process?
When the London Plan is put up as an example of a strategic, as a spatial development strategy, everyone goes, "What? It's going to be 300 pages long."
Yeah, starts off 900 and over the years, grow.
So, as long as these things will need to be kept really short and sharp, but I see them as setting out the broad locations within the area for strategic growth, and most importantly, probably the vehicle for divvying up housing numbers between the constituent authorities. And the trick, given that the government is intending to have these spatial development strategies in place by the time of the next election, it is going to be to avoid the mission creep that we've seen happen with the London Plan.
Great detail on every subject under the sun, rather than just a broad brush approach.
I take quite a radical approach, which is, I reckon they should start with thinking, can this be reduced to an A3 piece of paper? it really is that sort of map you used to get with structure plans, showing some blobs of where the growth will be, and with some inset tables showing how housing and maybe employment floor space is going to be divvied up, and really to avoid gold plating. But if I can be rude to any planners who are listening, planners just like to plan and and to go further than government policy and to be slightly more utopian. But I do think we need to be really pragmatic if this is going to work.
Given the many three-hour project calls I go on chaired by planners, I fear that brevity will not be the first word that springs to mind. But so that's covered foundation authorities, and for those still keeping track, that then takes us on to mayoral strategic authorities. Now, there's actually 11 currently in England, which covers 50% of the population. It's a bit of a hodgepodge at the moment with respect to the devolved powers on planning. So, for instance, the Mayor of Cambridgeshire and Peterborough has no current power on housing or planning. In Tees Valley, the Mayor has responsibility for a mayoral development corporation and a housing delivery team, whereas the Mayors for Greater Manchester and London, as you mentioned, in London, have strategic planning powers. Under the reforms proposed, all mayors will be given new development management plans, power, similar to the Mayor of London, including the ability to call in planning applications and strategic planning, plus control of grant funding for regeneration and housing delivery, which is a really fundamental, going back to that word, radical change, it seems to me. We're awaiting for the full details, but in areas such as Cambridge and Peterborough, where we're working together on projects, this really could represent a fundamental change. Do you think it's for the better that we're moving to this system of mayors with such strong powers?
I do think it's for the better, because with Cambridge as an example, I think the current system is almost impenetrable to anybody, what the role is of a mayor who doesn't have planning powers. It's crazy, and the way in which, to their credit, the authorities are working together pretty well jointly. But if I was a constituent in Cambridge, I wouldn't know who to complain to. But the politics are going to be really difficult, aren't they? Well, first of all, I thought the lesson from the last Labour government's attempts to introduce regional assemblies was that the public aren't really that interested in regional mayors. So do we have an obstacle there? And then the other issue is the political issue of where you have, differing political complexions at different tiers.
And that, I think, is where the challenge is going to come. And incidentally, the fight against the North East devolution mayor, of course, launched a career of Dominic Cummings, who led the campaign against that. So look at the unintended consequences that follow on. I share your view, because, again, Cambridge and Peterborough, Sarah, I mentioned, because we do a lot of work there. And it's not inconceivable you could have a Conservative or maybe even a Reform mayor, judging by polling across the country, who is anti-Greenbelt release. You would have Lib Dem councils who are sceptical about Greenbelt release, I think it's fair to say, and Labour councils who you would expect to be broadly supportive of the government aims, although we do see areas where Labour councils are saying, oh, hold back a bit here, please, government. So whilst the government has said this represents a permanent shift of power away from Whitehall and into the hands of those who know their communities best, it struck me, if the community's representatives disagree with what the government is trying to achieve, then is there not the possibility we could end up with Whitehall imposing plans on whole regions that a mayor and a majority of the local councils don't want? And it strikes me we're going to have this push and pull tension between local politics. And as we all know from the work we do, most communities are opposed to development near them, and a Conservative mayor approving a large Greenbelt release spatial development strategy coming up against the government, I'm struggling to see how this is going to be an easy process. I don't know if you have a view on how.
I do agree, and the government are going to have to show that they're not just bluffing when they keep talking about using their powers of intervention, which they do in relation to call-ins, and of course we've seen a high-profile example or two of that already, but also in relation to plan making. And I find it all this politically a bit confusing, because simplistically, a lot of power is, although we talk about devolution, a lot of this is the opposite of devolution, really. It's powers going up from current district councils to combined authorities, county authorities counties, etc. And my simplistic view of local politics was that, for example, counties are more likely to be conservative than urban-based districts. Yeah. So is this leading to conflict?
When you have one party in power, you end up locally, at the next local elections, usually, I think pro-reform in the mix now, but it usually goes against Labour to Tory, Reform, Lib Dem. So realistically, in 2 to 3 years' time, the majority of local authorities will not be Labour-controlled. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, including mayoral levels. And that's the other main area of focus for identified, was this broader local government reform and reorganisation. So again, apologies for a little bit for getting into the weeds here, but in areas with two tiers of local government, i.e. district and county, the government wants them to move to a single, what we call unitary council, with an interim combined county authority, whereby effective levels of collaboration will need to be demonstrated. So for most areas in the country, the government wants this to create councils with a population of 500,000 or more, with the bill saying an ambitious first wave of reorganisation will happen in this parliament, so we have to assume by 2029 is the intention. Now, interestingly, PricewaterhouseCoopers say this has the potential to create £700 million a year in annual savings. And again, interestingly, in Cumbria, creating a unitary council reduced the number of councils by two-thirds and replaced seven council leaders with two. I'm not quite sure how two works, but that's the that's what's come out. So, taken individually, all the reforms we've spoken about for the last 30 minutes or so, I mean, clearly have their merits, but there's an awful lot of change, it struck me, going through all of this in a short period of time, and could lead to a lot of uncertainty. Now, it's always said, whatever the outcome, the lawyers always win. But for your clients pursuing planning applications, do you think the next 2 years or so is going to be harder or easier, given the change which is coming?
What we all do is always going to be hard. It's always going to be hard. But I think that clients are going to be seeing more consents come through for development. But that is going to be...
Do you think at a local level or at a national level called in? Do you think councils will realise that the sword is of Damocles is hanging over them if they don't approve and if they recognise that they're local plan? Or do you think they'll take the easy decision of, well, politically we can say no, we know we've got to hit targets, government will call it in so we can make the government be the bad guys? I'm kind of torn on how I see this is going to...
I'm sure we'll see more local decisions. You know, one other really important proposed change we haven't talked about is the proposal that more application decisions are taken by way of delegated powers. Which...
So does that mean if a scheme is local plan compliant, the onus is on the local authority to delegate that decision? Which takes the power away from elected members, which a lot of them, as a former councillor myself, will fight kicking and screaming. But that is for change. So if a developer puts in a scheme broadly complying with a local plan, is there a size limit to that? I'm just trying to think, if it's 300 homes, that's quite a lot. I'd imagine local councils and people would want to say in that. Is there a threshold limit?
Well, the consultation document invites views. There's three options for how this should work. And it's not going to be easy because, as we know, when officers decide that a scheme is going to go to committee or isn't going to go to committee, there are people on the sidelines who are seeking to attack that that administrative decision. Yeah. So, and it's easy to say, oh, if the scheme is generally in accordance with the local plan, then it should be determined by officers, but then you're going to have arguments about whether it is actually generally in compliance with the local plan, etc. But
and also local awareness of what a local plan actually is, and what the implication of a local plan is. That's what strikes me as the slight tension which could arise there.
Yeah.
Because 99% of residents in the borough do not know there is a local plan, what it is, what it's about, and all of a sudden a planning application comes in at the end of the road. I can really see that. Again, I agree with the change in principle, but it does seem that there's going to have to be a few kinks signed out of this, I think. But again, it's that devolution down to power, but actually it's getting further away from people.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking earlier about the language which politicians use, and I was joking at an event the other day about this government is still using the language that the last government used of, you know, changes have to be turbocharged and Angela Rayner was talking about the rubber hitting the road and all of that. Mm-hmm. It's as if we're sort of all riding some motorbike. But the problem is we're meant to be riding this motorbike really fast at the same time that all of the parts of the motorbike are being replaced. And that's going to be really the challenge for all of us as to how, if we're at local authorities or working with local authorities, how we can be bringing forward plans whilst the system is changing. And when we're working for developers, how we can be promoting schemes whilst knowing that, you know, even the authorities that we are dealing with are changing.
It might not be in existence by the time it gets to planning. You might not need to go to committee. It
really is a sort of four-dimensional process.
I do feel for council officers, I must say, are going to have to oversee quite radical changes over the next... of course, in this parliament, if the government's ambitions are to be met, it's real pressure on local authority officers. In some of the councils we work, I always think of Cambridge and the South Cambridge and the Greater Council. Must have more large-scale application than any other council in the country. And the government is supporting that part of the country. But across the country, this is, local authorities are starved of resource. So I just hope the government is going to support them in this.
And I hope the government is... you know, great at communication, but probably better than it is at the moment in terms of explaining in words of one syllable why this is good and necessary and how the issues which so often are thrown up against the prospect of development are going to be dealt with. You know, the fact that, you know, the infrastructure isn't provided in a timely way and all the rest of it. You know, there does need to be really good communication if we're not going to get into, I think, increasingly adversarial situations.
Well, and I think we can bring the podcast to a conclusion by saying my work at Town Legal and Consilio, that communication can be done clearly to people.
Absolutely.
You know, it's going to be a challenge, but hopefully enjoyable next couple of years as we all look. I think we all share the government's aim of getting things built.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's that aim, and we want to help deliver on that.
Yeah, no, it's all really interesting.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for your time, Simon. And thank you very much for everyone who's listening. Thank you very much.
So, that's it from us. Thank you for listening to this special episode of Consilio's Better Places podcast. You can listen to our back catalogue of episodes at consiliocomms.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe on whatever platform you listen on. Bye-bye for now.